month-long war between Israel and Hamas is intensifying on the ground in Gaza.
Israeli society has never been as mortally wounded as we are now.
Plus, families of those captured by Hamas are increasing pressure on the Israeli government to obtain their release.
We are fighting to get them back.
And U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has wrapped up his grueling Middle East tour in Turkey.
We're working, as I said, very aggressively on getting more humanitarian assistance into Gaza.
Today is Tuesday, November 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Rick Pantaleo. The month-long war between Israel and Hamas is intensifying on the ground in Gaza. As civilian casualties in Gaza mount, U.S. and international leaders are calling for a temporary ceasefire to allow humanitarian aid to enter Gaza. But Israel insists the humanitarian crisis of its 240 hostages must be resolved first. Linda Gradstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
In Israel, the public is focused on the fate of some 240 hostages, including 30 children. Demonstrations in support of the hostages are intensifying, with demands that Israel not agree to a ceasefire or allow humanitarian aid into Gaza until the hostages are freed. Former hostage negotiator Gershon Baskin says he believes most of the hostages are still alive and being held in underground tunnels in Gaza.
They are probably being cared for as hostages in a situation like this might be cared for. I don't believe they're being physically tortured. They probably have minimal food necessary to stay alive and water and maybe even a little bit of medical supplies, but they are still seen by Hamas to be valuable assets to free Palestinian prisoners from Israeli jails.
Israelis say the hostage kidnappings and brutal murders of 1,400 Israelis, most of them civilians, as well as the rising toll of soldier deaths in the ground invasion of Gaza, have profoundly shaken their sense of security. Yossi Klein Halevi is a senior fellow at the Shalom Hartman Institute.
Israeli society has never been as mortally wounded as we are now. It's not only the mass numbers of casualties and the hostages, but it's also the way in which 1,000 Israelis were butchered, the helplessness of how they died. And that negates the founding ethos of this country. Israel was created to be a safe refuge for the Jewish people. Not the promise of Israel was not that there would never again be genocidal enemies, but that never again would Jews die helplessly.
In Gaza, civilians are also feeling helpless. The high death toll and widespread destruction has left the 2.2 million Palestinians terrified and forced many to flee their homes. Although the Israeli army has warned civilians to evacuate the northern part where its ground operation against Hamas targets would be concentrated, there were recently several Israeli airstrikes in the southern part of Gaza, which was supposed to be a safe zone. Kara Matar lost several family members in a recent Israeli airstrike.
When they bombarded us, I lost consciousness. My brother, Zaid, and two cousins were martyred, and a third is still missing. And the owner of the house and his son died too. Perhaps more than 10 people were martyred, and everybody else got injured.
The central Mughazi refugee camp also suffered from Israeli airstrikes, which terrified the children of Palestinian journalist Rami Al-Magheri, a Mughazi resident. He says that international negotiations on the future of Gaza are the only way out.
I believe politically, the pressure politically could come out with something tangible, could come out with sort of a breakthrough in the upcoming period that would lead to some sort of a lasting solution for Gaza.
A solution to the conflict will only come after much more fighting wipes out the Hamas military infrastructure, according to Israeli political and military officials. But even Israel's steadfast American allies are beginning to exert pressure to allow a temporary ceasefire, a demand Israel has so far rejected. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
The Palestinian militant group Hamas has held about 240 Israelis and citizens of other countries for a month. Now their families are applying pressure on the Israeli government for their release. At the same time, the families are terrified that a wrong move could endanger their loved ones. VOA's Natasha Moskovaya reports from their protest encampment in Tel Aviv, Israel.
A crowd in Tel Aviv, Israel, rallying in support of the Israelis and others held hostage by Hamas for a month now, chants in Hebrew, Achshav, Achshav, meaning now, now.
Every moment that Inbar and all the others are there, it's risking their life, and all the airstrikes and the ground invasion is really risking their life, so we cannot wait anymore. We are expecting from our politicians to do everything to bring them home now, to pay any price.
Noam Alon, whose girlfriend Inbar Hyman was kidnapped October 7 from the Supernova Music Festival in South Israel, says that after protesting almost daily for the past month, he is sleeping in a tent in front of the Israel Defense Forces headquarters in Tel Aviv, along with other people whose loved ones were abducted to Gaza.
We are fighting to get them back. We are begging on any platform, anyone with influence, just to get them back. They are innocent people who did nothing wrong, old people who need their medications. I can't even imagine where they are or what is being done to them.
4 weeks have passed, with Hamas still holding about 240 hostages in Gaza. Their families decided to ramp up the pressure on the Israeli government to make sure their release is top priority. Families are frustrated not only with the government, but also with the world, which they feel cares mainly about humanitarian access to Gaza civilians. Lisa Shpalansky speaks of her 19-year-old cousin Karina Ariev.
And we saw a video of her being kidnapped by Hamas. She was with two other girls inside a jeep. We saw that she was hurt in the face. And other than that, we don't know anything. Nobody tells us because nobody knows. Hamas doesn't release any information about whether they're fine.
She says the Israeli Defense Forces gives 200% to bring the hostages back, but the world needs to do more.
They're hypocrites when they call us out for trying to get back our families. But if it were their family, wouldn't they move heaven and earth for them?
Israeli artist Hila Galili has built several installations calling attention to the hostages. She says her work reflects the impossible situation of their families.
Hostages' families are in a situation where they can't talk because of the fear of retaliation against their loved ones. The hostages also can't raise their voices because they're locked up and they're tied up. So I'm standing like this, and sometimes when you're standing silent, the scream is much louder.
One of the hostages' relatives told the crowd that humanitarian aid should be cut to Gaza until the Israeli hostages receive aid as well. Others demanded release of the hostages as a condition for a ceasefire. All seem to agree that with the military operation in Gaza, the hostages are in harm's way, and the Israeli government and the rest of the world need to do more to secure their release. Natasha Mozgovaya, VOA News, Tel Aviv, Israel.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has wrapped up a rigorous Middle East tour in Turkey after only limited success in efforts to forge a regional consensus on how best to ease Gaza's civilian suffering as Israel intensifies its war against Hamas. Speaking with reporters before leaving the Middle East, Secretary of State Antony Blinken says the U.S. continues pushing to help Gaza civilians.
We've engaged the Israelis on steps that they can take to minimize civilian casualties. We're working, as I said, very aggressively on getting more humanitarian assistance into Gaza, and we have very concrete ways of doing that, and I think you'll see in the days ahead that assistance can expand in significant ways.
Blinken met Monday with Turkey's foreign minister, Hakan Fidan, in Ankara. We're following these other stories from around the world. A man who was accused of physically assaulting a woman in Antarctica was then assigned to look after the safety of a professor and three young graduate students on a remote ice field, according to documents obtained by the Associated Press. Survivors of an earthquake late Friday that flattened villages in Nepal's northwest mountains have been searching through the debris of their collapsed homes for any salvageable belongings as aid trickles into the remote area. The spectacular Aurora Borealis, also known as the Northern Lights, were seen in multiple regions of central Russia overnight into Monday. An intense solar storm made the Northern Lights visible further south than usual. The Aurora Borealis display occurs when particles from the sun make their way toward Earth and collide with our planet's atmosphere. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Rick Pantaleo. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky says a criminal investigation is now launched into a deadly Russian attack on Ukrainian soldiers in Zaporizhia. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Calling the attack a tragedy that could have been avoided, Zelensky tells Ukrainians that criminal proceedings have been initiated in response to the tragedy, and that the main thing is to establish the complete truth about what happened and prevent such an incident happening again. Ukraine has confirmed that 19 service members have been killed in the Russian missile strike in Zaporizhia during a military awards ceremony. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
November 6th is the International Day for the Prevention of Environmental Exploitation in Times of War and Armed Conflict. According to the Ukrainian Prosecutor General, the environmental damage of war in Ukraine is about $56 billion. The worst disaster was the Kakhovka Dam collapse. Here's how Ukrainian eco-activists and law enforcement gather the proof of eco-crimes. Lesha Bukalets reports.
Eco-activist Yulia Marhel takes samples of water from the Ingulets River, which was impacted when the Kakhovka Dam was destroyed in a blast in June of this year. She fixes on the camera the time and location. It is 11:22, the city of Snyugurivka of Mykolaiv region, Ingulets River. Ukrainian authorities blame Russia for blowing up a part of the dam. Russia denies the accusation. Still, the impact of the blast was immediate. Eco-activist Yulia Marhel explains that the way of water from Kakhovka Dam went 200 kilometers through 80 villages and cities. The level in small rivers nearby rose. In Snyugurivka, Ingulets River is typically 60 meters wide. After the blast, it was up to 1.5 kilometers. Members of the eco-activism group Let's Do It Ukraine have already made 3 expeditions to research harm from the Kakhovka Dam's destruction. But they say the real scale of the tragedy is difficult to calculate. Marhel says that her team takes water samples and looks for toxic substances. So, after the research, they will know the general effect on the environment, sea animals, and fresh water sources. But she adds, the activists need to find out what's on the other bank of the Dnipro River. This territory is occupied now by Russians. Some water samples are frozen and will be transported to European labs for additional research. Ukrainian scientists have already found heavy metals in the water. Yuri Olejnik, a scientist at the Ukrainian Scientific Center of Ecology of the Sea, says that from an environmental point of view, these substances have exceeded the maximum permissible concentrations. In addition of being toxic, he says, they are also carcinogenic. They can accumulate in the human body and cause cancer. According to activists at Let's Do It Ukraine, the Kakhovka Dam catastrophe is the second worst in Europe after the 1986 accident at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant. The office of the Ukrainian Prosecutor General calls the dam's destruction ecocide. Максим Попов, special advisor to the Ukrainian Prosecutor General, explains that according to Ukrainian national legislation, ecocide is defined as the mass destruction of flora and fauna, air and water pollution that can lead to an ecological disaster. He highlighted that harm to the environment has no borders, no citizenship, no nationality. Incidents such as the Kakhovka Dam attack have a cross-border nature. Ukraine is one of the first countries in the world to make ecocide a crime. The country is also working with worldwide eco-organizations to make ecocide an international crime.
We push for an international crime because that is where the International Criminal Court is, where there is no immunity, even for the top leaders. And also because there's a level of coherence achievable that way, and a way of people taking it seriously, because that is, of course, where the worst crimes are considered.
$56 billion is the preliminary cost of environmental damage caused by the war in Ukraine. And as activists point out, ecology is not like a house or city. It cannot be rebuilt in a year or two. Lesia Bakales, VOA News.
In Nigeria, advocates for the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies are calling for urgent action to save the country from the brink of famine. The UN reports that more than 15% of the population is currently undernourished, and the number is rising. Gibson Emeka has the story from Abuja, Nigeria, narrated by Carol Van Dam.
Less food, more water. That's how 41-year-old Ruth David recounts the acute food shortage faced by her household and how they are coping. Life's been hard since the mother of three fled with her family to Abuja, Nigeria's capital city, after a deadly Boko Haram attack on their village in Borno State, northeast Nigeria.
But you will not eat that you will satisfy.
We don't eat to satisfy our hunger. We just manage. We cook small, add a lot of water to it. The children will sleep. And we know we have survived that day until the next day.
That is the way we are manage the food.
After over a decade of living in a camp for internally displaced persons, or IDPs, David still relies on food donations to feed her children. David says things are worse now as food donations to the IDP camp from humanitarian organizations have dwindled due to the tough economic situation in Nigeria.
But now they are not coming.
Now they are not coming. It takes like 6 months. We don't share food at our store. They're not coming with food again.
They are not coming with food again.
As of September this year, there were an estimated 24.8 million food insecure people like David countrywide, according to the UN. This year, the Global Hunger Index, a European charity tracking hunger globally, found that Nigeria ranks 109 out of 125 countries. The index's parameters assessed undernourishment, child stunting, wasting, and mortality. Climate devastations, inflation, and insecurity are the major drivers of food insecurity in Nigeria. Hopewell Munyare, operation manager at the International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, says recent global conflicts and disasters are adding to the lack of response to the needs in the country.
Our efforts will always be, you know, competing with other interests. For instance, we have the Russia-Ukraine war, which has its own impacts on Nigeria and the rest of Africa in terms of food insecurity. There's a critical issue around that. We have now the Israeli-Pakistani war, which is also happening. We have situations of like the Syria-Turkey earthquake that happened. So in those areas, those immediate or urgent disasters where resources usually would tend to quickly go also affects our resource mobilization.
The Nigerian government declared a state of emergency for food insecurity in July 2023. Humanitarian agencies have continued to scale up health and nutrition interventions to the most vulnerable communities. Humanitarian advocates like Munyari are urging the government and stakeholders to map out long-term strategies to attain food security and halt the hunger crisis. For Gibson Emeka in Abuja, Nigeria, I'm Carol Van Dam, VOA News.
A testy exchange between Donald Trump, lawyers for both sides, and the judge as the former president testifies in his civil fraud lawsuit trial in New York, which accuses him of dramatically inflating his net worth. Associated Press correspondent Julie Walker reports.
At one point during his first day of testimony, Donald Trump raised his voice as he criticized the judge and the state attorney general who brought the civil fraud lawsuit against him and his company. She was sitting in the courtroom observing. Trump continues to say his properties are worth a lot more than what they say and that there was no fraud on his part, instead calling the case, the judge, and the AG frauds. As he was pressed on the veracity of his financial statements, Trump lashed out, "You go around and try and demean me and try and hurt me, probably for political reasons." Before the day's testimony, State Attorney General Letitia James said the facts speak for themselves. At court, I'm Julie Walker.
Incumbent U.S. President Joe Biden is trailing his predecessor and likely Republican opponent Donald Trump in key swing states a year before Election Day, according to a New York Times Siena College poll released on Sunday. Reuters' Almond Lee reports.
New U.S. presidential election polls out on Sunday showed Joe Biden trailing his predecessor, Republican frontrunner Donald Trump, in five of the six most important battleground states, 12 months ahead of Election Day. The polls were conducted by the New York Times and Siena College. They showed Trump with a lead in Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, and Pennsylvania, while Biden is ahead in Wisconsin. Presidential elections are often determined by the outcomes in a handful of so-called swing states, which could swing and be won by either major party, and which become targets of both of their campaigns.
That's Reuters' Almond Lee. Here's a reminder that the third Republican debate is scheduled for Wednesday, November the 8th. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, this is Rick Pantaleo wishing you good luck, good health, and good news tomorrow.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Pentagon is sending an additional 300 U.S. troops to the U.S. Central Command region, which includes the Middle East, announced Pentagon Press Secretary Air Force Brigadier General Patrick Ryder.
These additional troops will provide capabilities in explosive ordnance disposal, communications, and other support enablers for forces already in the region. We will not discuss specific deployment locations for these forces, but I can confirm they are not going to Israel and that they are intended to support regional deterrence efforts and further bolster U.S. force protection capabilities.
Brigadier General Ryder noted the conflict between Israel and Hamas, which began October 7th with the horrific slaughter of Israeli civilians, has resulted in broader tensions in the region. That is why, he said, the U.S. has deployed additional capabilities to provide us with the options necessary to respond to a wide variety of contingencies. Brigadier General Ryder said those forces are really there for two things. One, to deter any escalation of a broader regional conflict, which no one wants to see, and then, two, to ensure that we have the forces and capabilities in the theater to protect our forces that are doing other important national security work, like the Defeat ISIS mission, like keeping the lanes of shipping open, and working with regional partners on air defense and things like that. There has been an uptick in recent weeks of attacks by Iran-backed militants targeting U.S. forces in Iraq and Syria, whose mission is the enduring defeat of ISIS. The U.S. responded with precision airstrikes in Syria on facilities used by Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps and affiliated groups. The attacks by the Iran-backed forces did not stop the work of the counter-ISIS mission. On October 29th, U.S. Central Command noted on X that since October 7th, Operation Inherent Resolve and its partners conducted 15 missions against ISIS, resulting in 2 operatives killed and 27 detained. Brigadier General Ryder emphasized that the U.S. precision strikes are separate and distinct from the Israel-Hamas conflict. The goal of the strikes is twofold: deterrence against an escalation into a broader regional conflict and protection of U.S. forces. Brigadier General Ryder had a clear message: we will continue to do whatever we need to do to protect our troops.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.